Take a network break. Steep a nice hot cup of tea, visualize the perfect virtual donut, and join us as we slice through the tech news FUD. I'm your host, Drew Comrie Murray, and joining me as always is Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you doing?
My introvert button is well and truly so far in that it's actually popped out into safety mode. I was very fortunate to be asked to speak in London this week for the Tech Unplugged event, which was, of course, a great pleasure and a great privilege. But now that I'm home, following Interop in Las Vegas last week, I am just like pull a duvet over my head and, you know,
you're done talking to humans.
I'm done talking with humans. Let's get back to podcasting.
Yeah, we can do this safely removed. We don't have to see each other. It's all mediated by technology.
There's no video conferencing around here.
Fantastic. All right, before we jump into the news, I want to thank today's sponsors. This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. I also want to thank ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur, and then share your insights with your vendors and customers. You can sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers. All right, on with the news. First, introducing OpenR. Facebook has been rolling out a BGP-driven fabric in its data centers, and now it's open to everybody? Or are they just what's going on here?
So Facebook this week absolutely took a fair shot at BGP and OSPF and ISIS in the networking world and kicked it into touch. And you know, I've been a bit known to rave a little bit about how stupid BGP is.
You do have a reputation for not liking BGP.
Clearly Facebook doesn't either. So what they've done is fundamentally said BGP isn't the right tool for the job, although they've been using it for their data center fabrics. And they've done pretty much what I've tried to communicate, except I'm really bad at communicating, is they're actually just using software to communicate between distributed treating the network as a distributed system. That is, if you've got lots and lots of different nodes, then you've got a really simple distributed computing problem. So what they do is they use a thing called Thrift, which is an Apache project, originally started by Facebook, I think, back in the mid-2000s or so, and then eventually open-sourced and in Apache Foundation. It's an event-based messaging system, so the software literally watches for events to happen, and then it triggers a message, and then it uses 0MQ for the message exchange. So that's why they avoid any of the hassle of defining a protocol. They don't need to write the software. They don't need to validate the theory behind the protocol. Just use software that exists already that is tried and proven. And then on top of that, they're just building apps. Using conceptually, in terms of the data architecture that you're using, it's conceptually similar to a state database that we use inside of, say, ISIS or OSPF, uh-huh. In that every node has to have consensual, you know, more or less the same version of the data and to be eventually consistent. But what they're using is, instead of doing it in some arcane piece of, you know, format using highly unique and obscure software to create OSPF messages or BGP messages, they're just using off-the-shelf code. This means, of course, that A, they're not paying anybody to write 90% of the code, and they've only got to develop about 10% of it themselves. Uh-huh. They're also able to build testing platforms, libraries of testing routines and stuff like that. So every time they build an app, they can just shove it into a testing harness that's all software and validate that all of the things interact. It's absolutely very, very exciting. So I have just spent hours reading over this and thinking about it and triggering down, following all of the rat holes that this opens up in the way I thought. And this is an incredibly clever way of taking the fundamentals of existing networking today, this idea of distributed state, you know, and the ability to program TCAMs. And, you know, if you've got Linux on a device and you've got x86 CPUs that have got more compute power than anything's going to, you know, OSPF and BGP were designed in an era when CPUs were like gold, special fairy powered, you know, brought in by the stork. The high priest. And if you could actually have 2 megs of flash RAM in your device, it was like, my goodness, you've absolutely spent money to get the latest and greatest, you know. Well, guess what? It's 2016. All that stuff is rubbish. All the theory that, you know, that OSPF and BGP are predicated on is a complete load of bollocks, and we can just move past it. And this whole idea is just really fascinating. And, of course, they're now actually rolling this out. So Facebook isn't just talking about this. This isn't some academic paper. This has real use. They have, obviously, the FBOSS applications that they've talked about previously. They run those on a Linux platform, on a Broadcom switch. Boom. Whole new generation of networking is starting to open up. Today they're using it internally. Tomorrow they're planning to open source it. And if that happens, I'm going to be really excited. I think there's going to be a lot of companies out there who are going to look at this and go, excellent. We don't need to have, you know, it supports direct control, so the SDN controller device type thing, but it also supports distributed. So you can choose how you want to use your network or how you want to configure your network. Very, very exciting. I'm going to be looking for this. I hope they announced it at a conference called Networking at Scale, which is an invite only. It's a closed conference. You basically got to be one of the blessed people to come. And shame we couldn't get there because I definitely would have loved to have been there. This completely changes the future of networking, in my opinion. If Facebook can build its own routing protocol and completely abandon the last 40 years of networking, if they can put it into their network and then open source it for everybody to use, it just revolutionizes the way we go forward.
It's amazing the impact that Facebook is having on the networking community, first through the Open Compute Project by open sourcing a bunch of hardware designs and specifications. And now if they put this software out there open source as well, it seems like it maybe has some potential here.
Well, it takes 10 to 20 people, I believe. I don't know how many people it takes for certain. It's not public knowledge, but it doesn't take, you know, like the Cisco model of 500 people to write a piece of software, because they don't have project managers and product managers checking what customers want, and then they don't have people working out how much they can sell it for, and then managing teams of developers. It's just a, you know, at the end of the day, those big teams, just there's only 10 to 20 people who write the code. The rest of it's how do I market and package it?
Sure, Facebook's not trying to sell us anything here. They're just trying to solve a problem, and yeah. Then if they're nice enough, they'll roll out that solution to the rest of the community and folks can adopt it or not.
That's right. But I think from my point of view, it proves that the old ways of networking can be tossed out. Now, of course, this doesn't mean that BGP and the internet is dead. Far from it. This doesn't mean that, you know, lots of people will continue to use the distributed computing architectures, which is fundamentally the routing protocols we use today are sort of specific implementations of distributed computing algorithms and theorems. But this shows that a company with, you know, some resources, and Facebook's not the largest, you know, Amazon would be larger, or Google perhaps. They're just doing this because I've got a problem, I need to fix it. Boom. And if we open source it, maybe we can get other eyes on the code and that will make it better. That's the power of open source.
That's right.
So hugely exciting. Just this idea of taking off-the-shelf components that already exist, putting them in your network switches and changing the way that you program the forwarding tables, because all it comes down to is forwarding tables in the device, TCAMs and FIBs, then boom, away you go.
All right, well, we'll have lots of links in the show notes if you want to go start digging around and see what this is all about. Okay, moving on. Bloomberg is quoting an unnamed source saying that the private equity firm Thoma Bravo is making a bid to buy Infoblox and take it private. Thoma Bravo, you've probably heard us talk about them before. They've got a strong stake in the tech sector. They acquired Riverbed and took it private in 2015. They did the same for SolarWinds in 2016.
Yeah, Infoblox is a strange company in the sense that it's really it's just about IP addressing tools. Mm-hmm. And you can take the IP addressing and then that's it. And they sell it like for $200 per IP address. It's a vast profit center for a very simple technology, and there's literally dozens of competitive products that exist in open source. And it kind of surprises me in this era of how Infoblox manages to stay in business against so many competitive forces. Now, in particular, Infoblox is struggling in the face of SDN, right? Because your graphical consoles, your network management is being taken over by your SDN platforms. Now, in the data center, of course, that's NSX or ACI or NewArge or whoever it is that you're using for that. In the case of Kubernetes, IP address management is in containers is just completely managed in the operating, in the platform above. Why do I need a separate app just to manage some IP addresses and add a DNS server when I can do it all from a DevOps environment? At the other end, in the campus, which is where a lot of people have been using it to manage, you know, what IP address was allocated to what branch and all that, you know, what devices are connected, well, that's all going to SD-WAN appliances. And why would an SD-WAN vendor bother to implement with Infoblox when Infoblox just has a handful of federal US federal customers of any great note to be bothered with? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I understand their business model. They have expanded their business model to say, you know, they've gone from IP addressing to DNS, so the IP is integrated with the DNS. Well, guess what? You can get that from Microsoft's Windows servers. They have a dynamic DNS server for free. Why would you upgrade to Infoblox? So strange, but Thoma Bravo is probably eyeing off its security division. It's got a bunch of tools, a bunch of products that they've tried to acquire over the years and haven't really been able to monetize them. Like, you know, once you buy them, you've got to make them accelerate their business in a whole. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't worked. I would suspect that Thoma Bravo is looking at the four pieces of business, the IP addressing, the DNS security. So they bought a cloud security company, which has cloud threat intelligence, and then attach that to a DNS service. So if you do a DNS lookup to a name that is known to be malware-driven or malware-enhanced, shall we say, uh-huh. then shut it down. And then they've also got a monitoring arm, which hasn't done so great, very long. I can't remember the name of products, about 20 years old, that nobody really wants anymore. So, yeah, maybe they want to break it up and chuck the pieces, you know. Keep in mind that Thoma Bravo also has SolarWinds, of course.
That's right, and Riverbed.
Yeah. So maybe I could pull the pieces out of Infoblox and throw the, you know, the management, the network monitoring and management piece over to SolarWinds, and they could do better with that. Or maybe they could fold the whole thing into SolarWinds, which makes much more sense.
Yeah, and speaking of which, Network World actually has an interview with Kevin Thompson, who's the CEO of SolarWinds, about the whole decision to go private. It's a pretty interesting read. Just as a quick summary, there were two major reasons. One was the acquisition price that Thoma Bravo put on the table. And the other one, somebody ends up with a bag of cash, you're like, ooh, we got to think about this. And the other one was they felt like the public market was pressuring them to grow faster than they really felt was sustainable. So a company takes them private, they can have a nice, you know, reasonable growth curve without that constant pressure to show more.
Again, I mean, SolarWinds is a great business. They've had a managed to target the medium, small medium, and, you know, and even up into some of the largest to buy graphical monitoring and management tools for networks, mm-hmm. right? Okay.
Yep.
But again, what does software-defined networking do? It gives you visibility and monitoring. It gives you much more. It gives you analytics. It gives you configuration. SolarWinds has no configuration engine for networking or servers. So they've got to go up the stack. And how soon can they do that? Well, they may never be able to do that because now they're competing against VMware's vCloud or OpenStack or SD-WAN vendors, or they're dealing against Cisco's DNA. What about NFV? How does SolarWinds transform into managing virtual appliances? Mm-hmm. They have all the parts, but how do they build a product which is compelling for the marketplace? And I suspect that they were struggling to define that. You know, one of the things that we know is that the vendors are struggling in this time of transition as we go from the old legacy IT to the next generation. Vendors aren't sure what the final products will look like, and they don't know where the direction going. And SolarWinds may not have been able to make a strong decision or been willing to bet on a play that goes in a particular direction and decided just to pull out of the market. You know, with the prices right, why don't you pull back and then think, move slowly to put a product into the market and wait for things to change before you shoot your load?
That's right. Take some of the pressure off, gives you a little time to regroup.
Yeah, I think SolarWinds needs to mature. You know, they bought a lot of companies over the last 10 years. There's lots and lots of competitive pressures between all the different businesses. Maybe it's time to look at how do I converge all those. I mean, this is the same thing Cisco's going through, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's got five different business units making 20 different types of switches and four different types of, you know, there's six or seven different types of SDN platform. And it's sort of very confusing for customers to know what you stand for. And also the cost of that, you know, in the old days when you were making gobs of cash, it was fine. But as the revenue slows down from the enterprise IT, you've got to be much more efficient. You're only going to get one shot at this. So maybe it's better to be in the private market where you could be confident about where you're going.
Right, and you can still make a profit. It just you're not under that pressure to keep ramping up that profit margin.
Well, the private markets sort of say, if you go to them and say, this is what we're going to do, this is going to take 3 years to execute, these are the milestones along the path, the public share market won't allow that.
That's right.
Well, or it'll penalize you as soon as you say, I'm going to shrink for 3 years before I grow again.
That's right. you will get hammered.
You'll get hammered. Whereas if they go private, and as long as the discussions are good, private might force you into some ugly decisions, of course. It might force you to sell off some businesses to fund cash flow, or it might force you to cut headcount, or maybe even to go buy, you know, grow even when you don't want to. But generally, it's a lot easier to be flexible or creative when you're held by a private ownership. That's what Dell's doing, for example.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we'll have the link if you want to go check out the interview. It's an interesting read. And now we're going to pivot to Salesforce. Of course, they had a big outage recently, affected West Coast customers, lasted almost a day. Customers lost data, and of course, the CEO, Mark Benioff, had to go to Twitter and say, oh, mea culpa. And Salesforce has a lot of unhappy customers to deal with. But my question is, how much leverage do those customers actually have? Are they really going to, you know, pick up their stake and leave if they feel like Salesforce isn't responding the way they want them to? Or are they stuck?
This is hysterical. Like, he had to apologize on Twitter. Oh, big effort. Did he make a press release? No, he picked up his phone and said, really sorry, things are broken. Big effort, right? Huge effort from a CEO, especially someone who's a regular Twitter, right? And it must, of course, be very embarrassing. A lot of these CEOs of technology companies are pretty egotistical. And having to apologize that, you know, something's not right often sticks in their craw. So maybe it is a big deal, but, you know, apologizing on Twitter is like, well, that's the least you can do, not a big deal at all. I think that one of the other things that this proves, I mean, aside from the fact that, you know, clouds break, and when they do, they break, grow, they have massive things.
They break
the great
hard,
thing
yeah.
about them as an enterprise person is you can just say it's not my fault, one. Second one, you can say it's all Salesforce's problem to fix. So it's not, you can just pretend it's not an issue. That's the advantage of the cloud. And if it's not working for you, more importantly, all your competitors are down as well.
That is also true. Although I have to feel like it's probably cold comfort for IT if there's a CIO or CFO screaming at them about all the lost business and they say, why can't you fix it?
The people who bought Salesforce are the sales managers. IT never bought Salesforce. So they're not getting, they shouldn't be getting the raw end of that stick.
Oh, come on. You know that raw end of the stick goes wherever the money wants it to go.
Probably, but it's not. Again, IT doesn't run Salesforce. Salesforce does.
Okay. Well, so they not, can take it as a moral victory the then.
Yeah. One of the other things too is when we were at Interop last week, you know, we talked about putting things in the cloud, and somebody said one of the big things about the cloud is that cloud providers take legal liability. And I went, no, they don't. This is exactly it. Do you really think Salesforce is going to pay back all the lost revenue you just experienced with the lost days of revenue? And even if something more serious happened, Salesforce doesn't take any liability for any sort of damages or failure of the system. Mm-hmm. So don't mistake, you know, what a salesperson says to you for reality. These people are not responsible for covering your debts or law process. Even if Salesforce lost all your data tomorrow because of a breach, they would not be liable unless you could prove gross negligence, which nobody's ever managed to prove an IT company of gross negligence in 30 years.
I mean, there's probably SLAs that folks are going to get a little bit back, but I don't know that it's going to compensate them for lost business.
Yeah, they'll get a refund for one day.
That's right.
Which, you know, which is going to be like, here's $500.
I mean, the thing is, folks have to remember that going to the cloud is a risk. You have to understand the risks and the potential repercussions, but also doing it yourself is a risk with its own set of repercussions. And so it's a question of balancing that risk and deciding which one is more worth it.
Yeah. I just, you know, be cynical about these things. Just remember that, you know, these things aren't straight, you know, whatever. But
cloud is not magic.
The pain doesn't go away. They have the same problems that everybody else does.
All right, moving on to Weaveworks. That's a startup in the container networking space. It's raised $15 million in a B round of funding. The lead investor here is GV, formerly known as Google Ventures. And this round brings the total investment in the company to $20 million. You know, so we talk about containers a lot. Docker acquired a container networking startup, Socketplane. They get most of the press. Google's interest here, are they trying to foster some competition in the container networking space?
I don't know. This is odd. I mean, Weaveworks is a fine product as far as it goes, but I don't believe that standalone networking products for containers have much of a future. I think we're going to need something that's going to extend. Like when people who build application infrastructures could just as easily use any other networking infrastructure. I don't know why this one needs money. Weaveworks is really obscure to me. I'm not sure what the win, why they want to do it.
Okay.
A hybrid cloud? Am I looking at it in the frame of an enterprise IT problem? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But, you know, maybe Google just had $15 million sitting around not doing anything and they thought, okay.
Well, they do, really. That's exactly true, I suspect. I mean, Weave is network monitoring, networking and monitoring for containers and microservices architectures. Google's big on containers. They want to pump up that ecosystem so that anybody, you know, Kubernetes and, you know, all that sort of stuff. We've talked about that plenty of times. Mm-hmm. So maybe putting a few million into something that's, you know, got some traction in the market might get more people using containers, which is good for Google Public Cloud.
That's right.
About the best. That's a very long bow to draw, though.
It is a pretty long bow.
And, you know, I still think that containers is, there's going to be those people who use containers in the public cloud. There's going to be people who use them in the private cloud. But I still broadly have the view that private cloud is a much bigger market than the public cloud. There you go. Anyway, that's the news.
All right, that's the news. Moving on.
WaveWorks got money for something we don't understand. That's probably just explained most of my life.
Didn't stop us from talking about it, but there it is.
There it is, yep.
This episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools needed to prepare you for IT certification. They've got over 1,000 hours of up-to-date, high-quality video content, and new courses are added weekly. And Greg, you want to tell us a little bit more about what's going on with IT Pro TV?
Yeah, so IT Pro TV is a great way to keep your knowledge and skills up to date and access the most important tools needed to prepare you for certification, if that's what you're into. Over 1,000 hours of high-quality video content, and there's new stuff being added every week. You can stream them to your favorite video device, Roku, Amazon Fire, Apple TV, or even just your phone while you're in the toilet. Not that we've ever done that. Course topics include Comp, TIA, CCNP, Microsoft servers, ethical hacking, and so ethical hacking, and a bunch more. You get virtual machine labs from Transcender, which is a bunch of practice exams. That's pretty useful. So as part of your subscription, if you're heading into the certification track, you go and get some learning there, and then you get some practice exams, which get you prepped to go. There's one low monthly subscription price. You can cancel at any time, and maybe you can get your whole company to sign up because there's corporate and group pricing available.
All right. Check out itprotv.com/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month or $570 a year, but there's a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up using our code NETWORKBREAK30. That's all one word, NETWORKBREAK30. Check out their courses, the live stream, and more. You'll also get 30% off the lifetime of your account, so that's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. So go check it out, and thanks to IT Pro TV for being a sponsor. Getting back to the news, there's a story in the Register from Chris Mellor about how Cisco needs to get serious about storage and start chucking some cash around.
Yeah, I think Chris is right. Cisco needs to stop sitting on the pot. It needs to poop and get off, basically, as they say. I don't know if you've ever heard that saying. Maybe
I've heard it, yes. Yeah, I don't usually use it, but yes, there it is.
It's one of these things. Cisco's trying to partner with everybody. It doesn't want to partner, wants to partner with EMC and Dell and HP and everybody. Bring anybody storage, we'll sell anybody everything. But I do think we're getting to the point where, you know, this partnership with to come up with their hyperconverged strategy isn't, you know, too convincing. Why are they outsourcing the development of that code? Why don't they own it? If they're going to build a hyperconverged, maybe they don't want to upset Nutanix and SpringPath and all the others.
Well, he's saying, I mean, Chris's point is that, you know, if they really want to be serious and hyperconverge, just buy Nutanix or SimpliVity. You know, they invested in SpringPath for their HyperFlex hyperconverged project, but Mellor's point is that it's just not enough when you look at how folks like Nutanix and SimpliVity are leading the market. And then you've got Dell EMC and HPE, and this is a quote from his article, leading a ferocious fight back. So
I agree. His point, I think I've said it for a long time, you know, Cisco needs to buy NetApp, which is probably the only one that's the right size for Cisco. But Cisco's hell-bent on partnerships. But partnerships aren't convincing. They always just remind me that, you know, well, we don't actually want to commit. We're not serious. We're just playing around. You know, we haven't got enough money. You know, pick one of your excuses that you like. We haven't got enough money. We can't make our mind up which one we want. Or we think storage companies are, you know. If storage is a booming marketplace and Cisco's not participating, why wouldn't they go into it? They've already beat the heck out of EMC. Now's the time to move in and pick up the pieces while EMC goes into a transition, surely.
Well, they bought I think it was an all-flash startup, Whiptail, a while back, and that didn't seem to go very well, so maybe there's some hurt feelings or burned fingers.
Well, they bought a startup and thought that they could scale it up and found out that they couldn't. So somebody inside of Cisco thought they could buy a small startup and then turn it into a big storage company and then promptly failed. Mm-hmm. I think they just need to, you know, instead of spending 10 or 20 million on a tiny little startup, they need to go and buy a big storage company with a proven track record and say, this is our storage strategy going forward, instead of saying, we'll partner with anybody. You know, anywhere, you know, resellers,
anyone, anywhere, we'll do it all.
Yeah, you know, we'll partner with Huawei, Lenovo, IBM, Oracle. You know, we're still buddies with EMC. Don't forget the V-Block, UCS, best of breed servers. But we compete, we don't compete. It's very confusing for people to understand. I'm not sure the world's ready for that level of uncertainty. And at the same time, open storage or open source software, open source storage software in particular, Ceph and so forth, continues to drain away any sort of ownership that the vendors want to have. If you don't have it, you're losing traction in the market.
Well, some unsolicited advice from Chris Malora at the Register. We'll have the link if you want to check it out. We had been talking a little bit about the decline in phone sales, and there's more fallout overseas from the slowdown in smartphone sales. Hon Hai, which is one of the largest assemblers of iPhones in Asia, reported that its quarterly profit fell 9.2%.
Yeah, the suggestion is that Apple in particular has not getting the sales that it used to get. It's not getting the growth that it used to get. How's that? It's not selling quite so. It's still a $50 billion.
It's only selling a billion smartphones.
Yeah, or something crazy. So as the suggestion is on Wall Street that Apple's sort of not selling as many phones as before. People aren't upgrading. It's not getting the – there's nowhere left for Apple to go and grow. You know, it's in China, but it's still holding the prices high. Android phones are slowing down. The market's becoming perhaps saturated. Mm-hmm. Everybody's got a phone, and they're not going to continue to throw them away every 2 years. They're starting to get 3 or 4 years out of their smartphones.
Yeah, I think this was inevitable once you reach that saturation point. And you know, Apple's getting a little bit of a hit for this, but it's interesting to see it also percolate through the rest of the infrastructure. All right, so moving on, time to check in on SD-WAN. We talk about SD-WAN, keep a close eye on the market. Silver Peak came out with a press release recently saying the company has racked up 300 customers for its SD-WAN product, Unity Edge Connect. If you've heard of Silver Peak, it's probably in the context of WAN optimization, but Silver Peak, along with Riverbed and Citrix, are pivoting strongly to capitalize on the growth of SD-WAN.
That's really interesting because Silver Peak's only been in the SD-WAN market for a few months, really?
Maybe a year.
Yeah. I'm sort of losing sense of time about SD-WAN in a lot of ways. But if you think that that Silver Peak has a huge installed base of customers using their WAN accelerators, and really it's just a code upgrade for them to turn on those software-defined WAN features, to get 300 customers. Remember that Cisco ACI has 1,400 customers but only 250 deployments. Mm-hmm. So and you consider the amount of money that Cisco ACI has spent on marketing and the sales force and the whippings and the beatings that have been going on in Cisco sales force to get that product out the door. That's an astonishingly fast take-up rate, even if you have it, to take out the hyperbole.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think so. But to be fair, you know, a data center SD-WAN upgrade is a heavier lift than throwing some appliances in some branch offices and connecting up that way. But you're right. The growth is significant.
Yeah. Well, I'm just trying to draw a comparison, right? You know,
absolutely.
Cisco ACI has been out there for 3 or 4 years, massive marketing effort. All of Cisco's sales force is out there. Silver Peak's come in and done an astonishingly good effort when compared to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's how you leverage your customer base. Don't make them throw away their hardware.
Right, right. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Don't do hardware-dependent thing. Just do it in software.
Yeah, it's all software. And I'm going to, you know, toot my own horn here. I wrote a blog recently about anticipating consolidation in the SD-WAN market. There are at least 20 companies right now chasing SD-WAN, which to me seems unsustainable, but when you look at somebody like Silver Peak or other companies that we know like Viptela and so on, their growth potential is so enormous and there's so much venture capital out there that I really can't see the number of competitors dropping significantly over the next couple of years because there's just so much growth potential here.
Not only is there growth potential, it doesn't cost a lot. So the flip, I agree with your fundamental premise, which is it's a growth market, customers want it, they're making money, they're saving so much money by avoiding private MPLS or private WAN and in transitioning over to a public WAN or internet. I'm starting to call the internet public WAN. I don't know why.
Everybody needs a label.
Yeah, probably since the AP Style Guide stopped saying you had to put a capital I on internet.
sure.
The flip side of this is that to make an SD-WAN product doesn't require billions of dollars. It just requires $10 or $20 million to get the software up, and then you've just got to make the devices and sustain them, right? So It's not like you have to be the traditional model of, oh, only Cisco can make routers because you need thousands of employees and tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to sell and support them. That is proving not to be the case. And when I say proving, I mean literally you can go and talk to people who've deployed these products for any of these vendors and they'll tell you, yeah, no, we just took our routers and threw them away, stopped having the support hassles, and it was a whole lot easier for us to work. So there's no reason for them to converge. There's no reason for consolidation in the market. Uh-huh. And there's still a great deal of variation. I'm still remain convinced, even after all the vendors we met at during the press briefings phase last week, they're all quite different in their approaches. We were talking to one yesterday that's based on a standard host identity protocol.
Yeah.
It's an SD-WAN play, but it's focused on the security part, not so much on the path management path or the overlay or the micro-segmentation capability.
That's right.
So, you know, it's like the storage market. How come there's like 40, 50, 60 storage startups and none of them seem to be settling out? I think there's enough use cases for it to go horizontal.
All right. Well, this is definitely something we're going to keep an eye on. All right. Pivoting to another sponsor message, thanks to ThousandEyes. As your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes. That's a huge problem when you're running critical applications, websites, and services. And this is where ThousandEyes comes in. It gives you visibility into every network your company relies on. So your corporate network, the internet, cloud service providers, all from one place. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. And with these vantage points, you get the most complete understanding of network topology, dependencies, and behavior. So with ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight from BGP routing and DNS to web server and layer 3 performance. You can quickly pinpoint the root cause of problems, such as device faults, congestions, and so on. And you can share data and insights with your vendors and customers to resolve problems faster. And here's a special offer just for listeners. You can sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. ThousandEyes is network intelligence you can see, and we thank them for being a sponsor. Jumping back into the news, earlier this month, Pivotal announced that they had raised $253 million in a C round, with Ford Motor Company and Microsoft leading that investment. Previous investors also included GE. And if you don't know what Pivotal is, it's a commercial version of Cloud Foundry, which is itself an open source platform as a service offering.
If you're a big company, you might have several thousand developers. I once worked for a company that had 20,000 developers in it. And the challenge inside of those environments, of course, is that those developers turn up on site to start at a new customer, and it could be anywhere from 12 weeks before they're actually cutting code. You get inside a company, they have to give you a laptop, then they have to give you the tools, then they have to give you access to the dev environments, then you start poring over the code, then you need access to the blah, 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 blah. Platform as a service says, person comes in, clicks on a web browser, and an IDE opens, and boom, they're developing. The idea being is that if big companies like, you know, Microsoft and Ford could get a consistent platform on which to write code in, and then also have a deployment engine. So the other side of platform as a service, that it's also a deployment system. So you can just say, write the code over here. All the tools that you need for source control and the integrated development environment and linting and checking and all that sort of stuff. And then you click a button and it goes straight into deployment. There's a pipeline of continuous integration, continuous delivery. That's Cloud Foundry is one of those. There are many others. But Cloud Foundry's got EMC behind it. EMC's got enterprise salespeople out on the road pounding leather, making customers feel important, certainly, you know, in the same way that Hermes handbags do the same thing for certain rich people. Uh-huh. And these companies are all biting off on the idea. And, of course, the best way, because Pivotal is fundamentally an open source project, that is anybody can download it, Pivotal's providing support, they've gone around a different way of cash raising, which is to say to customers, why don't you just buy part of the company?
Yeah, that's what's really amazing, that a company, you know, we've got a couple of old school manufacturing companies, Ford and GE, actively investing in this platform, which tells me that, you know, they're doing some key stuff here, and they want to make sure that this is a going concern.
Well, in the era of open source, you know, of buying commercial software, and this was related to the panel I did at Interop, if you're going to get involved in an open source project, you want to know that the open source project is going to be around. And as a commercial company, you're probably used to, you know, forking over money to people like SAP and Oracle and giving them like just astonishingly large sums of money for not very good levels of service.
Truckloads of money.
So you might want to give it, you know, this is like a halfway house. It's a half pregnant thing. I think you're either in with open source or you're not, kind of thing. You know, I think this sort of like, oh, we'll take ownership of the company that manages the open source project is like, there's something fundamentally flawed. But I can see the logic at an executive level that doesn't quite embrace the future, you know. This might be a real innovation to them, but everybody around them is kind of looking at them going, like, what?
Well, I mean, that there is definitely some comfort in knowing that there is a company ready to do some handholding and some support. That's why Red Hat has done as well as it has, because it provides that extra layer around an open source project that makes it feel a little bit more there.
Yeah, I can't help but wonder if that's just a vestigial outcome from the years gone by where we always had to pay for something. Free software was too was too good to be true, or was perceived to be buggy and unreliable, or was perceived to be, you know, something. And yet what we're finding today is that open source is no more or less buggy than commercial software. Support is no worse or better than commercial software. Why wouldn't you not pay for the commercial part and get the same results?
Well, I think this is a point that you've raised several times, is that companies tend to invest in products rather than people, and open source actually requires people. Yes. And so having,
so this is the halfway point.
That's the halfway point. Yeah. You're investing in a not quite a product, but you're sort of renting the people.
Yeah, that's what I mean. If you're only halfway there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, a few more teenage years and then open source will be much more of a thing.
Okay, a couple of big acquisitions in the U.S. cable market happened this month, including a $78.7 billion acquisition of Time Warner Cable and Bright House Networks by Charter Communications. The FCC approved this deal in early May. And according to a story in Ars Technica, this merger means that Charter is going to nearly quadruple in size and have the second highest number of subscribers in the U.S. behind Comcast. The second part of this news is that the FCC also recently approved a deal to let a Dutch provider called Altice acquire Cablevision, which is a U.S. broadband provider. And the Register says this deal is worth $17.7 billion. So a lot of money happening, a lot of changing hands moving around, and some pieces starting to shift in the U.S. broadband provider market.
Well, he is hoping it leads to some deregulation of some sort and, you know, a true capital market, like a free capital market, instead of the current tightly controlled communist style, you know, I got rights that the government gave me and you can't take them away from me kind of thing that these companies that currently enjoy. Uh-huh. I am hopeful that 5G will start to give us options. So I'm trying to track the 5G technology and try and understand how that'll impact it. And it begins to look like 5G could be a viable replacement for cable. And some companies might be getting out of cable for that reason.
Well, it's interesting. There's another story about Verizon in my hometown, not Philadelphia. There's reports that the Philadelphia City Commission is asking citizens, you know, Verizon was supposed to come in and bring cable to the entire city, but we're hearing reports that it's not everywhere. So if you're a citizen and you're trying to get Verizon and you can't because they're telling you it's not available, let us know because we want to hold Verizon's feet to the fire. And the issue is that, you know, if Verizon is dragging its feet here, it's because they don't want to sink any more money into a cable rollout with, you know, 5G cellular connections, you know, down the pipe.
There's going to be high-speed modes in 5G that are going to give like 1 gig connectivity. Uh-huh. The question is whether the 5 gig towers can be put up. There's a whole bunch of problems here. You know, putting towers up is obviously people don't like seeing towers to do wireless, but they love having mobile phones.
Well, yeah. You
know, the dichotomy doesn't escape me.
Hey, we want our cake and we're going to eat it too.
That's right. And damn it if the government isn't going to give it to me.
That's right. Or okay. A big, giant, evil company, either one.
Either one, yeah. But I do think that some sort of deregulation needs to happen in the American market. It'll be in the interest of the American economy, and I'm not the person who says that. There's a lot of other people as well. But this, you know, these are big deals. Cable in the ground is worth money still. So hopefully these people can find ways to be more competitive going forward.
I would love to see it. I'm not going to be very positive about it, but would love to see more competition.
That's what we need, like proper competition, not government managed competition.
Right.
Well, you need protections. The cable should be owned by the state. The services from the cabling should be owned by companies. Mm-hmm. Is my general view. I'm hoping to being wrong. That's not a mandate, by the way. Just saying what I've seen work in the UK and Australia.
All the libertarians out there can send you angry email messages.
No, don't bother. It's fine. Thanks.
That's right.
It's worked elsewhere. There's no reason why it can't work at other places.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks liked what you're saying or they just want to argue about it, where can they get more from you?
You can find me on Fine Social Media, Facebook page. I've got a LinkedIn. I'm there. You can sign up for me there. I put notices and updates there. And I do regularly converse on the Twitter, but mostly please come visit my blog at etherealmind.com.
And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and I am on Twitter at Drew_CM. I want to thank our sponsors, IT Pro TV and Thousand Eyes, for helping to support the show. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please give us a like on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share a link with your colleagues. And you can check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to subscribe at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.